Yes, Papa? Jonas said, peering up at the hole. You're very brave to have come. You must all stay together. I know you'll take good care of your sister and mother while I'm away. I will, Papa. I promise, said Jonas. When will we see you? Papa paused. I don't know. Hopefully soon. I clutched the bundle of clothes. Tears began dropping down my cheeks. Don't cry, Lina. Courage, said Papa. You can help me. I looked up at him. Do you understand? My father looked at Andrus, hesitant. You can help me find you, he whispered. I'll know it's you, just like you know Munk. But you must be very careful. But, I started uncertain. I love you both. Tell your mother I love her. Tell her to think of the oak tree. Say your prayers, children, and I will hear them. Pray for Lithuania. Now run back. Hurry! My chest hurt and my eyes burned. I started to walk but stumbled. Andrus caught me. Are you okay? He asked. His face looked soft, concerned. I'm fine, I said, quickly wiping my eyes and pulling free of his grasp. Let's go find your father. No, you heard him. Hurry. Run back. Tell your mother what he said. But what about your father? I asked. I'm going to try a few more. I'll meet you back at our car, he said. Just go, Lina. You're wasting time. I hesitated. Are you scared to go alone? No, I'm not scared, I said. My father said we should stay together, but we'll go by ourselves. I snatched Jonas by the hand. We don't need him, right, Jonas? Jonas stumbled, looking over his shoulder at Andrus. Chapter 12. Halt! A voice commanded. We were so close, nearly under our train car. NKVD boots marched toward us. I tucked my thumb and Papa's wedding band into my palm. Davai! The voice yelled. Jonas and I crept out from under the car. Lina! Jonas! Yelled Mother, leaning out of the train. The officer pointed his gun at Mother, signaling for her to be quiet. He then circled around us, his boots coming closer with each turn. I felt Jonas edge up beside me. I tightened my fist, hoping the guard wouldn't see Papa's ring. We dropped some things down the bathroom hole, I lied, lifting up the bundle. Mother translated my words into Russian for the guard. The officer looked at the socks on top of the heap I was holding. He grabbed Jonas and began searching his pockets. I thought of the ham in my dress. How could I explain a slice of ham in my pocket when we were all so hungry? The guard shoved us both to the ground. He waved his rifle around our faces, yelling in Russian. I huddled near Jonas, staring down the barrel of his gun. I closed my eyes. Please, no. He kicked gravel at our legs and then spat, Divai! Pointing toward the train car. Mother's face was ashen. She did a poor job of hiding her fear this time. Her hands trembled and she was nearly panting. You could have been killed. We're okay, Mother, announced Jonas. His voice shook. We went to find Papa. Where's Andrus? Mrs. Arvidus looked over our shoulders. He came with us, I said. But where is he? She demanded. He wanted to look for his father, I said. His father? She sighed deeply. Why doesn't he believe me? I've told him again and again that his father... She turned around and began to cry. I realized I had made a great mistake. I should not have left Andrus behind. We found him, Mother. We found Papa, said Jonas. People crowded toward us. They wanted to know how many men were on the train and if we saw their loved ones. He said he thinks we're going to Siberia, Jonas reported, and he gave us some ham. The three of us ate it, but we saved a piece for you. Lina, give Mother the piece of ham. I reached in my pocket and handed the piece of ham to Mother. She saw it. the ring on my thumb. "In case you need money," I said. "He said you could sell it." "And he said to remember the oak tree," said Jonas. Mother took the ring off my thumb and put it to her lips. She began to cry. "Don't cry, Mother," said Jonas.
"Girl," shouted the bald man, "what else did you bring to eat?"
"Lina, give this piece of ham to Mr. Stallus," said Mother, sniffing. "He's hungry." Mr. Stallus. The bald man had a name. I moved toward him. His withered arms were green and purple with bruises. I held out the piece of ham.
"That's your mother's," he said. "What else do you have?"
That's all he gave me.
"How many cars were on that train?"
"I don't know," I said. "Maybe 20?
"He said we're going to Siberia?"
"Yes."
"He's probably right, your father," he said.
Mother's crying subsided. I held out the piece of ham again.
"That's your mother's," said the bald man. "Make sure she eats it. I don't like ham anyway. Now leave me alone."
"He wouldn't come with us," my brother explained to Mrs. Arvidas. "He and Lina started fighting, and he said he was going to check more cars." "We weren't fighting," I interrupted. "If they find him wandering around and discover he is the son of an officer," said Mrs. Arvidas. She hid her face in her hands. The gray-haired man shook his head and wound his watch. I felt guilty. Why didn't I stay with Andrus or insist he come back with us? I looked out of the train car, hoping to see him. Two Soviets pulled a priest down the platform. His hands were bound and his cassock was dirty. Why a priest? But then, why any of us? Chapter 13. The sun rose and the temperature in the car climbed quickly. The wet smell of feces and urine hovered over us like a filthy blanket. Andrus had not returned, and Mrs. Arvidas wept so hard it scared me. I felt sick with guilt. A guard approached the car and handed up a bucket of water and a bucket of slop. Everyone surged toward the buckets.
"Wait," said Miss Grebus, as if she were directing her class. "We must all take just a bit to ensure everyone can eat."
The slop resembled gray animal feed. Some children refused to eat it. Jonas found the package from Mother's cousin, Regina. Inside was a small blanket, a sausage, and a coffee cake. Mother shared the food, giving small pieces to everyone. The baby continued to wail. Ona twisted and screamed right along with the child, who still refused to eat and looked a darker shade of pink. Hours passed. Andrus didn't return. Mother sat down next to me.
"How did your father look?"
she asked, smoothing my braids and putting her arm around my shoulder. "Not too bad," I lied. I put my head on her shoulder.
"Why are they taking us? Is it really because Papa works at the university? That doesn't make sense."
The bald man groaned.
"See? Like him," I whispered. "He's not a teacher. He's a stamp collector, and he's being deported," I said.
"He's not just a stamp collector," said Mother under her breath. "Of that I am certain. He knows too much."
"What does he know?"
Mother sighed, shaking her head. "Stalin has a plan, my love. The Kremlin will do anything to see it through. You know that. He wants Lithuania for the Soviet Union, so he's moving us out temporarily."
"But why us?" I asked. "They already moved into Lithuania last year. Isn't that enough?"
"It's not just us, dear. I imagine he's doing the same to Latvia, Estonia, and Finland."
"It's complicated," said Mother.
"Try to rest." I was exhausted but couldn't sleep. I wondered if my cousin Joanna was also on a train somewhere. Maybe she was near Papa. Papa said I could help him, but
How could I help him if we were really going to Siberia? I dozed off, thinking of Andrus, trying to see his face. As I walked by the piece, my feet stopped. The face. It was enchanting, like nothing I had ever seen. It was a charcoal portrait of a young man. The corners of his lips turned up, yet, despite his smile, the pain on his face made my eyes well with tears. The subtleties within his hair blended so softly, yet created strong variation. I stepped closer to inspect. Flawless. How did he achieve such sheer shade without so much as a pause or a fingerprint? Who was the artist, and who was the young man? I looked at the signature. Munk. "Young lady, follow the group, please. That's part of a different exhibit," said our guide. Some of the students had complained earlier. How could they complain about a field trip to the art museum? I had been looking forward to it for months. The guide's shoes clacked down the tile floor. My body moved forward, but my head remained fixed on the drawing, fixed on the face. I rubbed my fingers together. A light touch, yes, but with confidence. I couldn't wait to try it. I sat at the desk in my bedroom. I felt the charcoal vibrate slightly as I pushed it across the page. The sound it made against the paper gave me chills. I bit my bottom lip. I ran my middle finger along the edge, softening the harsh line. Not quite, but almost. I pushed the tip of my finger through the dirt on the floor, drawing his name. Munk. I would recognize his art anywhere, and Papa would recognize mine. That's what he meant. He could find me if I left a trail of drawings. Chapter 14. When I woke, the car was dark. I moved to the front and hung my head over the side for air. My hair swung away from my neck. A rush of air swirled around my face and I breathed deeply. Gravel crunched. I snapped my head up, expecting to see a guard. No one was there. The gravel shifted again. I dropped my head back down, looking under the train. A dark figure huddled near the wheel. I squinted, trying to focus in the low light. A bloody hand lifted toward me, shaking. I pulled back before realizing. Andrus. I turned toward Mother. Her eyes were closed, her arms wrapped around Jonas. I looked out on the train platform. The NKVD marched two cars down, their backs to me. The little girl with the dolly sat on her knees near the door. I put my finger to my lips. She nodded. I lowered myself down off the car, trying not to make a sound. My chest thumped, remembering the guard pointing the gun at me. I stepped closer and stopped. A truck drove by somewhere outside, its lights momentarily sweeping under the car. Andrus stared off with a blue, battered face. He had swollen pillows for eyes. His shirt was covered in blood, his lips sliced. I knelt down beside him. "Can you walk?" "A little," he said. I peeked out to see the guards. They stood in a group smoking four cars down. I tapped lightly near the bathroom hole. The grouchy woman's face appeared. Her eyes widened. "I have Andrus. We need to get him back on the train." She stared at me. "Did you hear me?" I whispered. "You have to pull him up. Move!" Her face disappeared from the hole. I heard scuffling inside the car and glanced down to the guards. I slung Andrus's bloody arm over my shoulder and grabbed him by the waist. We rose an inch toward the door. The gray-haired man hung his head over, signaling for us to wait. Andrus sagged on my shoulder, making my knees bend. I didn't know how long I could hold him up. "Now," said the gray-haired man. I thrust Andrus toward the man who, together with the others, pulled him up. I peeked out at the guards. Just as I moved, they turned and began walking toward me. Desperate, I looked around. I grabbed onto the undercarriage of the train and lifted my legs up, suspended under the car. The sound of the boots came closer and emerged near the wheel. I closed my eyes. They were speaking in Russian. A matchstick hissed, and a glow appeared on the guard's boot. They chatted in low voices. My arms began to shake, trying to hold on. Hurry. I hung there. My hands began to sweat. I was losing my grip. Leave. A deep burning washed through the fibers of my muscles. Their conversation continued. Please. I bit my lip. Move. A dog barked. The guards walked toward the sound. Mother and the gray-haired man pulled me up. I slumped against the open door, gasping for air. The little girl with the dolly put her finger to her lips and nodded. I stared at Andrus. Dried blood caked his teeth and the corners of his lips. His jaw was swollen. I hated them, the NKVD and the Soviets. I planted a seed of hatred in my heart. I swore it would grow to be a massive tree whose roots would strangle them all. How could they do this? I asked aloud. I looked around the train car. No one spoke. How could we stand up for ourselves if everyone cowered in fear and refused to speak? I had to speak. I'd write everything down, draw it all. I would help Papa find us. Andrus shifted his legs. I looked down at him. Thanks, he whispered. Chapter 15. I woke with a start next to Jonas and Andrus. The door to our car had been closed and locked. People began to panic. The engines let out a hiss of steam. Please don't move unless you absolutely have to, ordered Mrs. Grubus. Make sure the bathroom area stays clear.
Mrs. Booklady, will you tell us a story? Asked the girl with the dolly. Mama, whimpered a little voice. I'm scared. Turn on the light.
Did anyone bring a lantern? Someone asked.
Sure, and I have a four-course meal in my pocket, too, said the bald man.
Mr. Stallis, said Mother. Please, we're all doing the best we can.
Girl, he commanded, look out that little slot and tell us what you see.
I moved toward the front of the car and hoisted myself up. The sun is beginning to rise, I said.
Spare us the poetry, snapped the bald man. What's happening out there?
The train hissed again, then clanked. NKVD officers are walking by the train with rifles, I said. There are some men in dark suits looking at the train cars. We felt a jolt and the train began to move. There's luggage everywhere, I said, and lots of food on the platform. People groaned. The station looked eerie, desolate, frozen with only remnants of the chaos that had taken place. There were single shoes strewn about, a cane, a woman's purse lying open, and an orphaned teddy bear. We're moving out of the station, I reported. I craned my neck to look ahead. There are people, I said. There's a priest. He's praying. A man is holding a large crucifix. The priest looked up, flung oil, and made the sign of the cross as our train rolled away. He was issuing last rites. Chapter 16. As we rolled, I reported every detail from the window. The ominous river, the big churches, buildings, the streets, even the trees we passed. People sobbed. Lithuania had never looked more beautiful. Flowers burst with color against the June landscape. We moved along. Our cars marked thieves and prostitutes. After 2 hours, the train began to slow. We're coming into a station, I said.
What does the sign say? Asked the bald man.
I waited for the train to move closer. Vilnius. We're in Vilnius, I said quietly. Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. We had studied the history in school. 600 years ago, the Grand Duke Gediminas had a dream. He saw an iron wolf standing high upon a hill. He consulted a priest about the dream, who told him that the iron wolf symbolized a large and formidable city, a city of opportunity.
Lina, may I speak to you, please?
The remainder of my classmates filed out of the room. I approached the teacher's desk.
Lina, she said, clasping her hands on the desk. It seems you prefer socializing to studying.
She opened a folder in front of her. My stomach leapt into my throat. Inside were notes I had written to girls in class, along with accompanying sketches. On top of the pile sat a drawing of a Greek nude and a portrait of my handsome history teacher.
I found these in the trash. I've spoken to your parents.
My hands became clammy.
I was trying to copy the figure from a library book.
She raised her hand to stop me.
In addition to being quite social, however, you appear to be a gifted artist. Your portraits are...
She paused, rotating the drawing.
Captivating. They show a depth of emotion well beyond your years.
Thank you, I breathed.
I believe your talent is above what we could develop here. There's a summer program, however, in Vilnius.
In Vilnius? I asked. Vilnius was a few hours away.
Yes, in Vilnius. Next year, when you're 16, you'd be allowed to enter. If accepted, you'd study with some of the most talented artists in Northern Europe. Would that interest you?
I tried to swallow my excitement long enough to speak.
Yes, Mrs. Pronis, it would. Then I'd like to recommend you. You'll fill out an application and submit some samples of your drawings, she said, handing the folder with the notes and sketches to me. We'll send them off to Vilnius as soon as possible.
Mrs. Pronis, thank you, I said. She smiled and leaned back in her chair.
It's my pleasure, Lina. You have talent. You have a successful future ahead of you.
Someone discovered a loose board behind some luggage on the back wall. Jonas crawled back and wiggled it aside. What do you see?
There's a man in the trees, said Jonas.
Partisans, said the bald man. They're trying to help us. Get his attention.
Jonas stuck his hand out of the opening in the board, trying to wave.
He's coming, said Jonas.
Shh! They're unhooking the cars with the men, a man's voice said. They're splitting the train in two.
He ran back into the woods. Intermittent shots rang out in the distance.
Where are they taking the men? I asked.
Maybe the men are going to Siberia, said Mrs. Rimmis. And we're going somewhere else. I preferred the thought of Siberia if that's where Papa would be.
Metal clanged and screeched. They were dividing the train. There was another sound.
Listen, I said.
The men. It grew louder. Louder. They were singing. Singing at the top of their lungs.
Andrus joined, and then my brother and the gray-haired man. And finally, the bald man joined in, singing our national anthem. Lithuania, land of heroes. I wept. Chapter 17. The voices of the men in the other cars had sounded full of pride, full of confidence. Fathers, brothers, sons, husbands, where were they all going? And where were we going? A train car full of women, children, elderly and infirmed. I wiped my tears with my handkerchief and allowed others to do the same. When it was handed back to me, I paused, staring at it. Unlike paper, the handkerchief could travel hand to hand without deteriorating. I would use it to draw on for Papa. While I devised a plan, the women in the car showed constant concern for the baby, who could not seem to nurse. Mrs. Rimmis urged Ona to keep trying.
Come, come, dear.
What is it? Asked my mother through the darkness of the car. It's Ona, said Mrs. Rimmis. Her ducts are clogged, and she's too dehydrated. The baby won't suckle. Despite Mrs. Remus's efforts, nothing seemed to help. We rolled for days, stopping in the middle of nowhere. The NKVD wanted to ensure we could not be seen and had nowhere to run. We waited for our daily stops. It was the only time the door would be open to light or fresh air.
One person, two buckets. Any dead bodies in there? The guards would ask.
We had agreed to rotate. That way, everyone would get a chance to get out of the car. Today was my turn. I had dreamed of seeing blue sky and feeling the sun on my face. But earlier, it had begun to rain. We had all scrambled to hold cups and containers out of the little slot to catch the rainwater. I snapped my umbrella closed, shaking the excess rainwater onto the sidewalk. A gentleman in a suit emerged from a restaurant, stepping quickly away from the drops I was splashing about.
"Oh, sir, I'm sorry."
"No trouble at all, miss," he said, nodding and touching the brim of his hat. The smell of roasted potatoes and spiced meat drifted out of the restaurant. The sun appeared, spreading a golden filter across the concrete and warming the back of my head. Wonderful! The concert in the park wouldn't be canceled tonight!
Mother had planned to pack a hamper with our dinner for a moonlight picnic on the grass. As I rolled the umbrella and wrapped the closure, I jumped when I saw a face staring at me from the puddle at my feet.
I laughed at my disorientation, smiling at myself in the pool of water.
The edges of the puddle shimmered beneath the sun, creating a beautiful frame around my face. I wished I could photograph it to draw later. Suddenly, a faint shadow appeared behind my head in the puddle. I turned around. A pastel rainbow arched out of the clouds. The train slowed.
"Hurry, Lina! Do you have the buckets?" asked Mother.
"Yes." I moved closer to the door. Once the train stopped, I waited for the sound. Boots and clanking. The door jerked open.
"One person, two buckets. Any dead bodies in there?" the NKVD commanded.
I shook my head, eager to get out. The guard stepped aside and I jumped down. My stiff legs gave way and I fell to the muddy ground.
"Lina, are you all right?" called Mother.
"Davai!" yelled the guard along with a series of Russian expletives before he spit on me.
I got up and looked down the length of the train. The sky was gray. Rain fell steadily. I heard a scream and saw the limp body of a child heaved out into the mud. A woman tried to jump out after the corpse. She was smashed in the face by the butt of a rifle. I saw another body thrown out. Death had begun to gather a crop.
"Don't delay, Lina," said the gray-haired man from our car. "Be swift with the buckets."
I felt as if I were dreaming with a high fever. My head seemed airy and my step unsteady. I nodded and looked up at our car. A group of heads stacked upon one another stared back at me. Dirt and filth clung to their faces. Andrus smoked a cigarette and looked off the other way. His face was still bruised. Urine streamed through the bottom of the train car. Ona's baby cried from inside. I saw the wet green field.
"Come here," it beckoned. "Run."
Maybe I should, I thought.
"Do it, Lina."
"What's wrong with her?" Voices began chattering from the train car.
"Run, Lina."
The buckets flew out of my hands. I saw Andrus limping away with them. I just stood there, looking at the field.
"Lina, come back in, dear," pleaded Mother.
I closed my eyes. Rain splashed against my skin and hair. I saw Papa's face peering down from the matchlit hole in his train car.
"I'll know it's you, just like you know Munk."
"Davai!"
An NKVD officer hovered over me. His breath reeked of liquor. He grabbed my arms and threw me toward the train. Andrus returned with buckets of water and gray animal feed.
"Hope you enjoyed your bath," he said. "What did you see out there, girl?" demanded the bald man.
I saw the NKVD throwing dead bodies off the train into the mud. two children. People gasped. The door to our car slammed shut.
How old were the dead kids?
Asked Jonas quietly. I don't know. I only saw them from afar. Mother combed through my wet hair in the dark.
I wanted to run, I whispered to her.
I can understand that, said Mother.
You can?
Lina, wanting to get away from this is perfectly understandable. But like your father said, we must all stay together. It's very important.
But how can they just decide that we're animals? They don't even know us, I said.
We know us, said Mother. They're wrong, and don't ever allow them to convince you otherwise. Do you understand? I nodded, but I knew some people had already been convinced. I saw them cowering in front of the guards, their faces hopeless. I wanted to draw them all. When I looked up at our train car, everyone looked sick, I said.
Well, we're not, said Mother. We're not sick. We'll soon be back in our homes. When the rest of the world finds out what the Soviets are doing, they will put an end to all of this.
Would they?
Chapter 18. We weren't sick, but others were. Each day when the train stopped, we'd lean out of the car and try to count the number of bodies thrown. It grew every day. I noticed Jonas kept track of the children, making marks with a stone on the floorboard of the car. I looked at his marks and imagined drawing little heads atop each one. Hair, eyes, a nose, and mouth. People estimated our path traveled south. Whoever was posted at the little window would call out when we passed markers or signs. My feet were numb from the vibration of the floorboards. My head was curdled from the stench and I itched terribly. Lice were biting down the side of my hairline behind my ears and in my armpits. We had passed through Vilnius, Minsk, Orsha, Smolensk. I wrote the path of cities on my handkerchief in ink. Each day when the door was open to light, I would add more detail in identifying clues that Papa would recognize. Our birthdays, a drawing of a Vilkis, a wolf. I made markings only in the center, surrounded by a circle of hands touching fingers. I scrawled the words pass along under the drawing of the hands and I drew a Lithuanian coin. When the handkerchief was folded, the writing was undetectable.
Drawing,
whispered the gray-haired man, winding his watch. I jumped.
I didn't mean to scare you, he said. I won't tell.
I have to get word to my father, I said, my voice low, so he can find us. I figured I could pass this handkerchief and that eventually it will get to him.
Very clever, he said.
He had been kind on the journey. Could I trust him?
I need to give it to someone who will understand the importance and pass it along.
I can help you with that, he said.
We had been rolling for 8 days when the train jerked hard and began to slow. Jonas was at the little window slot.
There's another train. We're coming up on a train going in the opposite direction. It stopped.
Our train car dragged, bleeding off speed.
We're pulling up alongside it. There are men. The windows are open on their cars, said Jonas.
Men? Said Mother. She quickly made her way to the window, swapped places with Jonas, and yelled out in Russian. They replied. The energy in her voice lifted, and she began to speak quickly, pulling for breaths in between questions.
For God's sake, woman, said the bald man. Stop your socializing and tell us what's going on. Who are they?
They're soldiers, reported Mother, elated. They're going to the front. There is a war between Germany and the USSR. Germany has moved into Lithuania, she shouted. Did you hear me? The Germans are in Lithuania!
Morale soared. Andrus and Jonas shouted and whooped. Miss Grebus began to sing, Take Me Back to My Homeland. People hugged one another and cheered. Only Ona was quiet. Her baby was dead. Chapter 19. The train with the Russian soldiers rolled away. The doors were opened and Jonas jumped out with the buckets. I looked over to Ona. She was forcing the dead child toward her breast.
No, she said through gritted teeth, rocking back and forth. No, no.
Mother moved toward her. Oh, my dear, I'm so sorry.
No,
Ona screamed, clutching her baby. Hot tears stung my parched eyes.
What are you crying for? Complained the bald man. You knew it was going to happen. What was the baby going to eat? Lice? You're all imbeciles. The thing is better off. When I die, if you're smart, you'll eat me if you all want to survive so badly.
He prattled on, grating, infuriating. The words distorted. I heard only the timbre of his voice thumping in my ears. Blood pumped through my chest and rose up my neck.
Damn you!
Andrus screamed and lurched toward the bald man. If you don't shut your mouth, old man, I'll tear out your tongue. I'll do it. I'll make the Soviets look kind.
No one spoke or tried to stop Andrus. Not even Mother. I felt relief, as if the words had come from my own mouth.
You're concerned only with yourself, Andrus continued. When the Germans kick the Soviets out of Lithuania, we'll leave you here on the tracks so we don't have to put up with you anymore. Boy, you don't understand. The Germans aren't going to solve the problem. Hitler's going to create more, said the bald man. Those damn lists, he muttered. No one wants to hear from you, understand?
Ona, dear, said Mother, give me the baby.
Don't give her to them, begged Ona. Please.
We will not give her to the guards, I promise, said Mother. She examined the baby one last time, feeling for pulse or breath. We'll wrap her in something beautiful. Ona sobbed. I moved to the open door to get some air. Jonas returned with the buckets.
Why are you crying?
He asked, climbing up. I shook my head.
What's wrong?
He pressed. The baby's dead, said Andrus.
Our baby?
He asked softly. Andrus nodded. Jonas put down the buckets. He looked over toward Mother holding the bundle and then at me. He knelt down and took the small stone out of his pocket, making a mark on the floorboards next to the others. He paused for a few moments, motionless, and then began slamming the stone against the markings harder and harder. He beat the floorboards with such force that I thought he might break his hand. I moved toward him. Andrew stopped me. Let him do it, he said. I looked at him, uncertain. Better that he gets used to it, he said. Used to what? The feeling of uncontrolled anger? Or a sadness so deep like your very core has been hollowed out and fed back to you from a dirty bucket? I looked at Andrus, his face still warped with bruising. He saw me staring. Are you used to it? I asked. A muscle in his jaw twitched. He pulled a cigarette butt from his pocket and lit it. Yeah, he said, blowing a stream of smoke into the air. I'm used to it. People discussed the war and how the Germans might save us. For once, the bald man said nothing. I wondered if what he said about Hitler was true. Could we be trading Stalin's sickle for something worse? No one seemed to think so. Papa would know. He always knew those sorts of things, but he never discussed them with me. He discussed them with Mother. Sometimes at night I'd hear whispers and murmurs from their room. I knew that meant they were talking about the Soviets. I thought about Papa. Did he know about the war? Did he know we all had lice? Did he know we were huddled together with a dead baby? Did he know how much I missed him?
I clutched the handkerchief in my pocket, thinking of Papa's smiling face.
"Hold still," I complained.
"I had an itch," said my father, grinning.
"You did not. You're just trying to make this difficult," I teased, trying to capture his bright blue eyes.
"I'm testing you. Real artists must be able to capture the moment," he said.
"But if you don't hold still, your eyes will be crooked," I said, shading in the side of his face with my pencil.
"They're crooked anyway," he said, crossing his eyes. I laughed. "What do you hear from your cousin Joanna?" he asked.
"Nothing lately. I sent her a drawing of that cottage in Nida she liked last summer. I didn't even get a note back from her. Mother said she received it, but is busy with her studies."
"She is," said Papa. "She hopes to be a doctor someday, you know."
I knew. Joanna spoke often of medicine and her hopes of being a pediatrician. She was always interrupting my drawing to tell me about the tendons in my fingers or my joints. If I so much as sneezed, she would rattle off a list of infectious diseases that would have me in the grave by nightfall. Last summer, she had met a boy while we were on vacation in Nida. I'd wait up every night to hear the details of their dates. As a 17-year-old, she had wisdom and experience, as well as an anatomy book that fascinated me. "There," I said, finishing the drawing. "What do you think?"
"What's that?" asked my father, pointing to the paper.
"My signature."
"Your signature? It's a scribble. No one will recognize it's your name."
I shrugged. "You will," I said. Chapter 20. We traveled farther south and passed through the Ural Mountains. Miss Grievous explained that the Urals were the boundary between Europe and Asia. We had crossed into Asia, another continent. People said we were on course for southern Siberia or possibly even China or Mongolia. We tried for 3 days to sneak Ona's baby out, but the guard stood near whenever the doors were open. The smell of rotting flesh had become unbearable in the hot car. It made me retch. Ona finally agreed to drop the baby down the bathroom hole. She knelt over the opening, sobbing, holding the bundle.
"For God's sake," moaned the bald man. "Get rid of that thing, I can't breathe."
"Be quiet," Mother yelled to the bald man.
"I can't," whimpered Ona. "She'll be crushed on the tracks."
Mother moved toward Ona. Before she reached her, Miss Grievous snapped the bundle from Ona and threw it down the hole. I gasped. Mrs. Rimmis cried.
"There," said Miss Grievous. "Done. It's always easier for someone unattached."
She wiped her hands on her dress and adjusted her hair bun. Ona fell into Mother's arms. Jonas clung to Andrus, spending nearly every minute by his side. He seemed angry all the time and so distant from his usual sweetness. Andrus had taught him a few Russian slang words I heard the NKVD use. It made me furious. I knew I'd have to learn a bit of Russian eventually, but I hated the thought. One night, I saw the glow of a cigarette illuminate Jonas's face. When I complained to Mother, she told me to leave him be. "Lina, every night I thank God he has Andrus, and you should too," she said. My stomach ate itself. Pangs of hunger came at relentless intervals. Although Mother made an effort to keep us on a schedule, I lost track of time and sometimes dozed off during the day. My eyelids were drooping when I heard it.
"How could you? Have you gone mad?"
A female voice shrieked throughout the train car. I sat up, squinting to make out what was going on. Miss Grievous hovered over Jonas and Andrus. I tried to make my way over.
"And Dickens, nonetheless? How dare you? You are becoming the animals they treat us as."
"What's going on?" I asked.
"Your brother and Andrus are smoking," she bellowed.
"My mother knows," I said.
"Books,"
she said, thrusting a hardcover in my face.
"We ran out of cigarettes,"
Jonas said softly. But Andrus had tobacco.
Miss Grievous, said Mother, I'll handle it. The Soviets have arrested us because we are knowledgeable, learned people. To smoke pages of a book is just... What were you thinking? Miss Grievous asked. Where did you get this book?
Dickens. I had the Pickwick Papers in my suitcase. Grandma had given it to me the Christmas before she died.
Jonas, you took my book! How could you?
Lina, began Mother.
I took your book, said Andrus. Blame me.
I certainly do blame you, said Miss Grievous, corrupting this young boy. You should be ashamed. Mrs. Arvidus slept on the other side of the car, completely unaware of what had transpired.
You're an idiot, I screamed at Andrus.
I'll get you a new book, he said.
No, you won't. It was a gift, I said. Jonas, Grandma gave me that book.
I'm sorry, said Jonas, looking down at his chest.
You should be, I yelled.
Lina, it was my idea, said Andrus. It's not his fault. I waved him away. Why did boys have to be such idiots? Chapter 21. Weeks. I lost track of how long we had been traveling. I stopped watching for bodies to be hurled from the cars. Every time the train pulled away, we left a litter of corpses in our wake. What would people think if they saw them? Would someone bury them? Or would they believe they were really thieves and prostitutes? I felt as if I were riding a pendulum. Just as I would swing into the abyss of hopelessness, the pendulum would swing back with some small goodness. One day, for example, just past Omsk, we stopped in the countryside. There was a small kiosk. Mother bribed a guard to let her out of the car. She came running back, her entire skirt bowed full and heavy. She knelt down in the car and released her skirt. Candy, toffees, lollipops, black licorice, mountains of gumdrops, and other treats spilled out onto the floor, unfolding like a rainbow in front of us. Bright colors everywhere, pink, yellow, green, red, and enough for everyone. The children squealed with delight and jumped up and down. I bit into a gumdrop. A burst of citrus exploded in my mouth. I laughed, and Jonas laughed with me. There were cigarettes, matches, and dark chocolate wafers for the adults. They didn't have bread or anything substantial, explained Mother as she divided the treasure amongst everyone. There were no newspapers. Children grabbed Mother's legs in glee, thanking her.
Foolish woman! Why do you waste your money on us? Said the bald man.
Because you are hungry and tired, Mother said, handing the man a cigarette. And I know you would do the same for my children if they ever needed it.
Bah!
He scoffed and looked away. 2 days later, while on the bucket run, Andrus found an oval stone full of quartz and other minerals. Everyone passed it around, oohing and aahing. Mrs. Arvidus joked and put it up to her finger as if it were a shimmering gemstone.
Didn't you know, she said, I'm a train car princess.
We laughed. People smiled. I almost didn't recognize them. I looked over at Andrus. His face beamed with a grin that changed his appearance entirely. He was handsome when he smiled. Chapter 22. After 6 weeks and the third day without food, the train stopped. They did not open the door. The bald man who had been charting our progress from the city markers called from the window slot. Guessed we were somewhere in the Altai region, just north of China. I tried to peek through the cracks in the wagon boards, but it was dark outside. We banged on the doors. No one came. I thought of the loaf of bread I had left on my windowsill, still warm and swollen from the oven. If only I could have a piece, just one small pinch. My stomach burned with hunger and my head throbbed. I missed drawing on real paper and longed for light to sketch properly. I was sick of being so close to people. I felt their sour breath all over me, elbows and knees constantly in my back. Sometimes I had the urge to start pushing people away from me, but it was no use. We were like matchsticks in a small box. Late morning came, and we heard clanking. The guards opened the door and said we would be getting out. Finally. My entire body trembled at the shock of daylight. I marked Altai on my handkerchief. Lina, Jonas, come here and comb your hair, Mother instructed. She smoothed out our clothes, a wasted effort, and helped me twist my hair into a crown. Twisting it made it itch even more. Remember, we must all stay together. Do not walk away or stray. Do you understand? We nodded. Mother still clutched her coat tightly under her arm. Where are we? Asked Jonas. Will they give us a bucket of water? I don't know yet, said Mother, fixing her own hair. She pulled out a tube of lipstick and with a weak hand applied the melted color to her lips. Jonas smiled. She winked back at him. The NKVD had bayoneted rifles at the ready. The sun reflected off the dagger-shaped blades. They could puncture us within a fraction of a second. Miss Grebus and Mrs. Rimmis helped the small children out first, and we followed. Andrus and the gray-haired gentleman carried the bald man from the car. We weren't at a train station. We were in a wide, deep valley surrounded by forested hills. I saw mountains in the distance. The sky had never looked so blue, so beautiful. I had to shade my eyes from the intense sun. I breathed deeply and felt the crisp, clean air draft my polluted lungs. The NKVD directed the deportees from each train car to sit in groups on the grass, 20 feet from the tracks. We were given 2 buckets of slop and water. The children lunged for it. It was the first time I had seen the other passengers. There were thousands of people. Did we look as pitiful as they did? Masses of Lithuanians with tattered suitcases and bulging bags poured out into the valley, dirty and gray with soiled clothing, as if they had lived in a gutter for years. Everyone moved in slow motion, some too weak to carry their belongings. I didn't have control of my legs, nor did most others. Many buckled under their own weight onto the ground. We must stretch before sitting down, sweetheart, said Mother. Our muscles have surely atrophied these past weeks. Jonas stretched. He looked like a filthy street beggar. His golden hair stuck to his head in matted clumps, and his lips were dry and cracked. He looked at me. His eyes widened. I could only imagine the state I was in. We sat down and the grass felt heavenly, like a feather bed compared with the wagon floor. The chugging motion of the train, however, was still trapped in my body. I looked at the people from our train car. They looked at me. Revealed by daylight, we saw the strangers we had shared a black closet with for 6 weeks. Ona was only a few years older than me. It had been dark when they put her on the truck in front of the hospital. Mrs. Arvidas was more attractive than her shadow. She had a very shapely figure, smooth brown hair and full lips. Mrs. Rimmis was a short woman with thick ankles close to Mother's age. People tried to communicate with the other groups, looking for family members and loved ones. The man who wound his watch approached me.
"Do you have a handkerchief I could borrow?"
he asked. I nodded and quickly handed him the hanky neatly folded to conceal my writing.
"Thank you," he said, dabbing his nose.
He turned his back to me and walked amongst the crowd of people. I watched as he shook hands with a man he obviously recognized, passing the fabric within palms. The man patted his brow with the handkerchief before putting it in his pocket. Pass it along, I thought, imagining the hanky traveling hand to hand until it reached Papa.
Elena, look, said Mrs. Rimmis. There are horse-drawn carts.
Mother stood up and looked down the row of groups. There are men with the NKVD. They're walking amongst the people. Andrus combed through his wavy hair with his fingers. He looked around constantly, watching the guards, yet keeping his head down. He had to be nervous. His face had healed but was still sallow with remnants of yellow bruises. Would they recognize him? Would they haul him away or kill him right in front of us? I moved near him, trying to position my body to conceal his. But he was taller, his shoulders wide. I looked at the sharp blades of the bayonets and felt my stomach pitch with fear. Ona began weeping loudly. "Pipe down," ordered the bald man. "You'll draw attention to us." "Please don't cry," said Andrus, shooting glances from Ona down to the guards. A group near the front of the train was herded into two horse-drawn wagons. They drove away. I watched as the NKVD walked with men from cluster to cluster. The men looked strange, certainly not Lithuanian or Russian. They had darker skin and black hair, and their general appearance was disheveled, primitive. They stopped at the group of people next to us and began talking with the NKVD. "Elena, what are they saying?" asked Mrs. Rimmis. Mother didn't answer. "Elena, they're..." She stopped. "What?" said Mrs. Rimmis. "They're selling us," she whispered. Chapter 23. I watched the men walking amongst the groups, surveying the merchandise. They made people stand, turn around, and show them their hands. "Mother, why are they selling us?" asked Jonas. "Where are we going?"
"Elena," said Mrs. Arvidus, "you must tell them that Andrus is a simpleton. Please. If not, they'll take him from me. Andrus, put your head down."
"They're selling us in groups," reported Mother. I looked around our cluster. We were mostly women and children, with only two old men. But we had Andrus. Despite his injuries, he looked strong and able.
"Do we want to be bought?" asked Jonas.
No one answered. A guard approached with a man. They stopped in front of our group. Everyone looked down except me. I couldn't help myself. I stared at the guard, who appeared well-rested, clean, and fed. I saw Mother cough into her hand and discreetly try to wipe off her lipstick. The disheveled man pointed at her and said something to the guard. The guard shook his head and waved a circular motion around our group. The man pointed at Mother once again and then made an obscene gesture. The guard laughed and began muttering. The man surveyed our group and then he pointed at Andrus. The guard walked over to Andrus and barked a command. Andrus did not move. My stomach braided up into my throat.
"He's slow. Leave him alone," said Mrs. Arvidus. "Elena, tell them."
Mother spoke one word in Russian. The guard grabbed Andrus by the hair and raised his face. Andrus stared blankly. Ona cried and rocked back and forth. Mr. Stallus moaned and grumbled. The man waved his hand.